My name is Peter Schaap. I generally, in my daily life, I do lots of embedded systems programming, which means I get confronted with all kinds of strange architectures, different hardware than people are generally used to, which is why I'm interested a lot in portability and getting code rights to work on more than one platform. The talk will basically consist of two parts. I will first do a part on what mainly users then see C++ programs, but there are also topics which concern all programming work in this session. I will first talk about that, give common problems, tips on how to solve them, and then I will go into a more abstract level on how a system in general, PC or workstation like system these days, is conceived, what the bottlenecks are, and then how people try to solve them and what impact that has on low level and also software which has to learn how. I'm not sure how far we're getting the second part, but I explicitly want to do the user guide part, which is probably the most useful for the new people first, and then see how far we get, and perhaps shorten a bit the second part. Why portability and who is concerned about this? One reason for me is correctness. I think we should try to get our packages as good as possible, which also means write code which conforms to the standards. And that's mostly what portability is about. Don't assume things which are not guaranteed by the standard. Debian claims to be the universal operating system. I don't think you can make this claim by running only on 1.2 packages. The third point is probably interesting, and I'm quite sure that most people are not aware of this, but there was this Linux devices poll among the readers which said which gave us the result that Debian is the most used embedded distribution. Now I think you should take this with a grain of salt in the sense that it's probably Debian is the most used as distribution to derive your own thing from to build an embedded system. I'm quite sure that there are not so many embedded systems actually running fully these Debian. But it's still a basis where a lot of people actually apparently draw their work from. So I think it's important that we care for this. And the most used actually means it's bigger than any of the commercial embedded distributions which are available.
Linux distributions or all operating systems?
Linux distributions, yes. It's not all the others are. Yeah. It's only within the embedded Linux space. Hardware advances will make Debian feasible on new platforms. If you consider that we now have tiny 10 gigabyte hard disks and even bigger sizes coming up, that mobile phones and other portable devices will come with hard disks. We will get like 64, 128, and more megabytes of memory. Come with like 600 megahertz processors nowadays. It becomes like you can run a full Debian on this machine. And yes, you can. I mean, the restrictions are moving quite fast. So Debian will become feasible on more and more portable and nice toys. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. It's just enlightening to see and interesting to play with machines which were conceived by people who have completely other ideas. And I think every Debian developer should actually be concerned with this in the sense that he should be aware of this, because it's not something a single or a small person or a small team can do for all packages, because it sometimes requires intricate knowledge on the internals of the package to actually solve it. It's mainly the case for virtual machines for this or smart part or whatever language. If there are portability violations in these codes, it can turn out to be very complicated if you don't know how Lisp interpreter works. And not all portable people know how Lisp interpreters or Java virtual machines, this kind of stuff works. And it's also, if everyone just takes care of this package, or the upstream takes care of this package, mostly conforms to the rules, the overall quality of the code will increase, even for platforms which are apparently working. Okay, now off to some practical things. C types. So there are a number of things that a C standard guarantees you, like the sizes of the basic types. So they are even somewhat spoiled. The account is always smaller than or equal to a short, and so on for int. You can be sure that short and int are always at least 60 bits, and on Unix machines you can actually assume that int is always at least 32 bits. A long is at least 32 bits, but on some platforms, on 64-bit platforms in general, it's 64. One main thing is pointers are not necessarily as big or can't be bigger than bits. This is typically true on Alphas and AV64, all 64-bit machines where pointers are 64 bits but the ints are still 32 bits. Now, we are lucky that GCC4 is warning us about this stuff, so I think more and more of these bugs will be noticed by the compiler. The sizes of a char are dependent. It means if you define a char variable, you don't know actually if you will get a signed or an unsigned char. This is very important if you, well, this can be important if you abuse chars for things which you are never meant for. If you use your char as a loop variable, which I have seen multiple times happening, and then you write a thing like, I'm going to be efficient and I write a decrementing loop, so I write e equals 10, while e is bigger or equal to 0, do the loop. If your cat is unsigned, it will never be bigger below 0, so it just effectively creates an infinite loop. And if that loop count is used as an index in an array, then yes, you will obviously correct memory at some point and get safe faults. So, a few tips. First, always use int. As long as you know that any specific requirement, like it must be a floating point or it must be a variable which I have to send to some other device or a network or a bus or whatever, and that device requires me to send 16-bit entities or the packet format requires me to have certain sizes, use int. The reason is compilers are always optimized to have the operations on it as fast as possible. And they are basically the native type of C. So if you have a loop variable, don't think about it of using a char to save like 3 bytes, because in most cases you actually don't save anything in it, worth anything. There are a number of cases where the code will be a lot slower because you have to execute 4 instructions to do something with it, with the 16-bit or 8-bit entity or something. So you don't do that. If you see this happening in a program, just replace the char by int and compile it, will mostly work. And complain to the main, to the upstream, that they shouldn't do this. Now there are obviously cases where you have to use specific sizes, like if you have to implement a binary protocol of TCP or UDP or whatever. And that protocol specification says like this field has to be 8-bit or this field has to be 16-bit or this field has to be a certain size. Then you have to use it. Luckily since ISOC 99, which is supported in GCC quite a good while now, we have standard types, which guarantee you like this is an unsigned int and it will be 8 bits long, and this is an unsigned int and it will be 16. So use those as much as possible, because they will, the compiler implementation will be sure, make sure that if you write u int 8, that you will actually get an 8-bit entity and not something else. So you don't have to worry about the portability anymore. That's how I have my tools. Like I said before, don't use chars to save memory. I've seen people doing that multiple times and generally it doesn't really work, because if you actually start looking at the assembly code, you'll quickly notice that you're actually losing memory, because you need more instructions sometimes to actually do operations on this cap. Which is okay if you use it as a string, but not if you use it as a string. Use the latest GCC version to compile your package. Even if that's perhaps not yet in Debian, it's worthwhile to just compile and see the warnings and possible errors, you can fix them. One reason is that new GCC versions tend to find more bugs. They tend to warn about things which were previously okay, they will now give you warnings. Like you assign an unsigned variable to a signed variable, that's not a good idea. or you assign a pointer to an int, be aware that the size might be different. If you use GCC version, you don't do that, and you do the compiler, you wouldn't notice that it would mostly work, but not always. Nowadays, the compiler is getting better. And obviously, it's always, I think it's useful to compile your program with the latest version, even if it's not yet in Debian, because at some point, the Debian compiler will upgrade anyway, and if you fix your build failures before the compiler into Debian, you probably save a number of bugs and work for all people. Then be aware of bitfields. That's for the next slide. Some people use bitfields. The idea of bitfields is that you can actually have a entity which is smaller than a single byte. And you can say, like, I have 32 bits, and the 32 bits are, this is like 8 bits, and I have two fields, a bit field which is 3 bits, and a bit field which is 5 bits. Now, most people assume the bottom structure in memory. So they assume that if you do it, that like the three lowest bits will be bit field 0, so if you write something to a bit field 0, you are actually changing the three lower bits. And they assume that if you actually access bit field 1, you will be looking at the 5 other bits. Unfortunately, it is not guaranteed by C specification in any way. And Intel does it the way mentioned on the second drawing, yes.
The second line, code, should it be 3 to 5? 3 length 5?
No, the number is the number of bits.
Just the name of the bit field.
Oh, the names. Oh, yeah, the name. Is bit field 0 or bit field 1? It doesn't have any specific meaning.
It's not start off.
No, just the length.
Okay, just the name. It could also be bit field A, bit field B, or large, or doesn't mean. Yeah, the slightly confusing thing is actually, it would actually have been better if the 3 bit part would always have the same thought. So, yes, colors are badly chosen. I should understand this. But the idea is that Intel, for example, PA32 sending us the lower way, while PowerPC does the upper way. So if you send a packet, it might be, if you actually rely on the lower ordering, then it will completely fuck up if you come on another platform. And then the problem is that if this is a network structure, for example, it might only show up, it won't even show up in compiling, because it will compile heavily. And then you run the program, and suddenly the other side doesn't know what you're talking about. And the other side says, like, blah, oh, this is not valid, like, throw away. Because you actually send in crap. And then you have to look in using TCP or network trace to look in the source code, like, why is it sending no packets? And then you realize the picture. And DNS is another, probably more common than known issue. So if you basically consider an int, a 32-bit entity, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. If you store it in memory in a little bit anyway, you'll see that it was first stored by 78 and stored by 56. Bit anyway is the way around. PDP in DNS is more for historic reasons than I think anyone. Well, there's actually one user, I know, the old SEO CS5 passes. But I think we can basically forget about it. But it's just to tell you that it's actually
a code wasn't stolen by Linux.
I don't know. I know it's in the Vitoni implementation, but fast. So that's why. But it doesn't really matter.
On little endian, 1.2 gets turned into World 3.
It talks to USB devices. All this every time you talk to send data to some outside entity, which is not on your processor, NDNS comes potentially into play, only if you have binary data. If you use everything ASCII or XML, then that doesn't count for you. But in all other cases, NDNS might be a problem, even if you run in Java or in Perl or in whatever. So the trick is never directly set your internal data structure to the outside world. Always have functions or at least macros which know about the convergence and do like, now I want to make a packet in memory and put this 32-bit entity and swap it to little entity, whatever CPU I have. Use macros which convert between the CPU and the NS, which is a platform dependent, but you can define the macro depending on which platform you are, and the specific NDNS you have to agree to. Yes, the Linux card, for example, does it quite nicely. They have this CPU to little NDNS, 32 micro CPU to little NDNS, 16 CPU to little NDNS, 64 CPU. So you just write like this field equals CPU to little NDNS, 32 value, and it will always give you a little NDNS, 32 bit value as a result. And you are always sure on the mobile platform you want to confirm to use the same for the game. Alignment is another problem in the sense that it's mostly C and C related, because you can only have a problem if you actually do direct quantum manipulations. The problem is that most risk processors require aligned access, or at least very much slower if you don't use aligned access. So what I mean with aligned access is if you have a 4-byte entity and a 4-byte int or an 8-byte mode, you always have to access it on a memory boundary of 4 bytes. So you can an aligned access of 4-byte number would be if you address it on address 0 or 4 or 8 or 12 or 16 and so on. But if you would access a 4-byte entity on address 2, you would have an aligned access. And would also, because same for 8 bytes. Unaligned access on 8 bytes would be if you would try to access 8 bytes at address 5, for example. The reason is that it's generally generally because your bus is like 4 bytes or 8 bytes wide, or even in some cases more wide. So the lower address bits are basically ignored. You just put on you just look at only the more significant instance, so the lower 2 or 3. Which means if you have an aligned access, you can do in a single cycle. You just put the address on it and you will get aligned data. But if you have an unaligned access, you can't do that anymore because your boundaries don't match and you have to actually do 2 accesses. And the hardware has to support it. Or the kernel has to support it. That's why in most architectures they are trapped by the kernel, so you get a processor exception and the kernel will fetch them and fix them up for you. So it will actually do the whole work of doing the 2 bytes and combining the right bytes into what you want. Unfortunately, this is slow, obviously, because you have a kernel trap for every memory access. And if you know how much cycles a kernel trap can take, you quickly realize you don't want it. It's also potentially non-atomic, obviously, because you're no longer doing a single access. And it doesn't work in kernel. In kernel, you're not allowed to do any sort of aligned access. But that's not so an issue for most people. So the best thing to do is don't do that. If you have, it's not always that easy, because you can easily get packets from network which have like 4 bytes entities which are aligned. I think SMB is probably one of the most famous protocols finding all sorts of alignment rules. The best way to cope with this is to actually copy the data into a new variable which is aligned. So do a memcopy or just a sign. No, memcopy is even better because then the compiler will actually look like all the other lines that can only do byte fetches. It looks strange, but it's in the end faster. In some cases, the compiler, if you do it right, the compiler can actually generate smart code and realize, oh, this is not like what you have to do. So you have to get it right. But that doesn't always work, because in some cases, if you do pointer arithmetic and you start using casts, then compiler obviously can't know what compile down what you're going to do, so the access might still turn out to be a map. Memory organization is not so much of a problem, except if you are into writing interesting virtual machines for this or Java or whatever. The point is that your program stack does not necessarily go downwards. So I think HPDA is the major machine which has an upwards growing stack. So if you think like, oh, I can just scan the stack by just taking my current stack point and going down, going up, then well, no, fuck, you're wrong. If you try to do games with variable lists arguments, this in C, like we have file hours or SD hours, and we have a variable number. If you think like, if you don't think like, oh, I know where the next argument will be because I know it's just the previous argument was like 4 bytes, so I just take my stack pointer and I look for the next one. It won't work because on some machines, on RISC machines typically, most arguments are kept in registers. At least the first 4 or the first 6 or the first 8, depending on the arguments, are kept in registers. And only afterwards they switch to the stack. So you might not even have a stack pointer to point you to the first. If you have like 3 arguments, you can't just take the address of the third to the second argument and find the next one, because it might be in a register, not entirely in memory. Which is why if you try to play these games, you will break on a lot of machines. Now, I don't think this is so much a problem in representing. Most people realize that it's just, you know, it doesn't work anymore. Okay, now, next part. Am I in line? Planning budget. 4:30.
It's okay.
It's okay. So, the next part will be more abstract in the sense that it will try to explain why we have caches, why we have DMA, do we have all these problems with it, and yeah, there are also problems that caching and non-coherency issues are quite annoying, and you would start wondering why do we have all these features if they're just annoying. Well, there are very good reasons why they, and I will try to explain it why it is. To explain this, I will first have to throw some very basic and schematic on how a block diagram, how a system might look like. It's not really representative for all systems which are available today, because, but it's a starting point. So on top of the slide, you have 2 processors that can actually be more than 1 processor, but more than 2 obviously, but I will generally call these CPU, even though it can be more than 1 CPU. If I really want to talk about more than 1, I will tell you, but CPU might, in some of the slides, might actually be more than 1 processor. The point is that all these processors have the same view on main memory. So if CPU 1 reads at address 0, it will be the same value than if CPU 2 accesses.
Well, but was AMD can say the 60?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but
yes,
I was changes just, a bit, so.
Yeah, the whole diagram does not hold for AMD 64. I know. And I will tell you about it in a minute.
okay.
So, this is more the classical Intel diagram. You have processors which have a shared bus which go to the bridge, and that bridge goes to the memory and also goes to what the peripheral bus, which is generally PCI, but can be, these days it's more PCI Express. Whatever. We have a number of peripherals going to this. Now, this is only one way to do it. For example, the AMD 64 systems don't do it that way. What they actually did was, like, and I will explain in a while why they did that, there is a very good reasons why they changed this architecture, is that they moved the memory access to the processor. So every processor in AMD 64 actually has its own memory subsystem. It has its own memory controller. I'm not sure if they have multiple channels these days, but they have even but doesn't really matter. They have a memory controller per processor. That doesn't mean you can't access the memory on the other processor. Yes, you can, because there are links between the processors, and if you access the memory location which is on the other processor, you'll send a message over the link and ask the other processor to fetch data for you and come back. Or write, obviously, depends. So, it is more like a non-uniform memory system, which was used up to now in big SGI and open and digital systems, where but it's the same thing AMD does. And they actually don't really have this non-bridge strategy, so they basically have, per processor, they have a sort of a bridge from hypertransport to, I think, PCI Express, they use these things, which is also transparent for the other one.
Yeah,
the others.
But the problem is still that you have one common interface for all buses and other interfaces in the computer. So you have like 6 CPUs with their own memory, 8.
Yeah, depends on how many you have, yeah.
And they all go over the NOS bridge to access the PCI stuff.
I would expect that every processor also has its own PCI.
No, that's the funny thing. They have only the memory controller on die, and
yes.
the NOS bridge only does PCI and other stuff. No,
I thought they need every 64. Oh, the NOS bridge is basically a hypertransport PCI Express bridge.
Yes, but.
And you have a hypertransport link for every processor.
Yes,
you know?
But.
Okay, there's only one processor which has this link to the.
No, all processors have links to one NOS bridge, which provides PCI access
to
all
links
CPUs.
That's
insane.
Silly. Okay, I would have thought it in a better way. Okay, fair enough. So the second thing is why it looks like you might think that this is a bridge, but actually there are systems which this CPU to peripheral bridge, the other end of the CPU peripheral side through the bridge, but the actual switch, you actually have separate links, and SGI does it in the XIO architecture. So basically, you have a separate link from another bridge to peripheral 1, a separate link to peripheral 2, and a separate link to peripheral 3, and if they want to talk to each other, they go via the node bridge, which also acts as a switch in the system. So they actually have, like, it's more like a network, a very fast one. Well, very fast. It was 1 gigabyte per second in 96, which was very fast for that time. But still, it's more like a network than an actual bus system. Okay, why do we have all these complicated things? Some observations. Processors became much faster than memory. You probably might recall the 486 times where we ended up with a processor which had 100 gigahertz and it was blazingly fast. And then we have Pentium 3, which is going to up like 1 gigahertz. Like, that's already 10 times faster. Now we are up to Pentium 4 and AMDs, which are like 2. I think Pentium 4 was up to 3.2 or so.
No, they are up to 4 nowadays.
Or 4 even, okay. and Optimum goes up to 2.6
yeah.
or so, whatever. Very
enough.
A lot. Memory, on the other hand, we had like in the 486 days, we had like 15 hours of CPU, I think it was about fast CPU. We do now have like double data rate 400 megahertz memories, so we do think that must be lots faster. Well, there's one catch. The memory patterns did go up a bit, but even 400 megahertz scaled to 3.24 gigahertz is like a factor of 10. So that would mean if you would actually access memory and you would actually be able to launch requests to the memory controller as 400 megahertz, you can't do that. I will explain later. But if you would be able to, it would still mean that if you would not have cache, every instruction would take 10 cycles just to fetch the instruction. That's obviously not very useful if to have 4 gigahertz processing in that case. So the problem with memory is that the latency didn't improve as much. I mean, it's a bit faster, but the time you need to do a single memory access hasn't improved all that much. So it still takes like I think up to 10 or more CPU cycles, no more, 20 even. Can be between 10 or 20 or 40 CPU cycles to just start the memory flash. Once you started it, the data comes flowing in at 400 MHz. So it means that 400 MHz times the bus value. But the beginning is very slow. That means, so the solutions to this are obviously use bursts. Don't ever do a signal transfer because the setup costs for transfer are so high that it only pays off to do it if you manage to transfer a lot of data at once. And how can you do that? You can either use processors, typically use caches, so you start to prefetch stuff, so instead of 16 instructions, you fetch like 16 instructions or 32 instructions at the same time, and you hope that you can actually use those, because otherwise it's just a waste. And for I/O bound things, it's generally useful to use DMA. Why? Because with DMA, you actually can program like, I want to transfer 500 kilobytes, but probably much more. Like, I can transfer 8 kilobytes from this port, this memory to this memory, from this bus in memory to another part. And the DMA controller actually knows, like, oh, I have to transfer 8 kilobytes, so I can just large burst 64 bytes at the same time and use my paging, my bus modes from both bus and memory as good as I can. You should be aware that this latency issue is not only to memory, but also for PCI. A single PCI I/O access costs thousands of CPU cycles. Just doing I/O reads in your program costs thousands of processor cycles, because you have to go through the bridge and on the PCI, just arbitrate from the bus, wait until the device replies, and come back. And all that time, your processor is doing nothing. It's really
well,
it's expensive.
Not really, because we have task switching.
That's a single instruction. So the
yes, well, it's a single instruction, yeah.
But you can't interrupt a single instruction.
Yeah, but so
we have multi-threading. I'm not sure that actually works for both calls, but still.
It works nowadays. The new technology from Intel does
that. Okay, that they're meeting the problem somewhat.
Yeah.
So you should do parallel execution, of course. You can do another cycle, but you can't do it from the kernel. So from the kernel, it's just one instruction.
Yeah, but
one instruction that is HMI.
Or yeah, but the CPU knows what it does nowadays.
Yeah, but
it's not intelligence to just see, wait, we are waiting for I/O, so we can just use another thread and go faster there.
Yeah, only if you have a CPU which knows about that.
Yeah, we need faster CPUs.
And it's not only obvious that's just doing I/O.
Well,
yeah,
and so the basic strategy is avoid programmed I/O as much as possible. Put it in packets in memory, write the whole buffer with everything you want to do, and then send it to the device, like do something for me and come back when you're done. Because in that case, your processor can actually do much more stuff while the device and the bus block is doing all the work. Yeah, I think I'm almost out of time, so. I'm not going to talk about this also. Non-covariant I/O is one of the most of the other slides are about problems which all these advanced scheme introduce. One of the issues, obviously, if you start to use DMA and all the other entities in your process accessing memory, you have to be sure that they all see the same thing. Definitely they are going to cache stuff, because they copy stuff, and if someone else changes it, then you obviously want to be sure that the copy is still up to date. Now, some systems do that in hardware. People have, well, most larger systems do it in hardware, and the smaller systems start doing it in hardware, but some don't, which means that all the processor actually has to realize, like, oh, wait, I'm going to do the DMA on this memory location, so I should not tell the processor to forget about all to flush the cache from this part of memory, because it's going to be overwritten by something the processor doesn't know about. There are all kinds of strategies which you can use to cope with this problem, but in the end, it turns out that if you want to use this, that it's rather complicated, and the only way to actually handle this problem is to by having properly coordinated access to devices, which means that you can't really do user-led I/O in Unix. It's really asking for trouble, because you can't just rely on the fact that if you write something to an I/O register, it will always be coherent and always do the right thing at the right time.
Okay,
I think that's enough for now. There are even more questions, so go ahead and feel free to ask.
No questions?
It's all clear, wow.
Yeah, keep this talk, I would say.
More problems.
Okay, so I would say we directly go to the next talk.
No.
Yes, we do.
No!
We don't.
What's the next one?
Switch laptops anyway.
Oh. About